You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
So, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you here for this special event. I think the debate on Twitter is going to be lively because we have, our guest, someone who's been at the forefront of some of the most dramatic episodes in European politics in recent years and joins us at a time of unprecedented crisis for Europe, which his country is involved in many ways, and of course at a defining moment for the UK's own future relationship with Europe. Yanis Varoufakis is a distinguished academic economist who rose to prominence on the global stage in 2015 when his Greek finance minister refused to accept the terms of the loan agreement imposed upon his country by Eurozone leaders. Having left government, he's since returned to academia. He's currently Professor of Economics at University of Athens, but he's remained, as we all know, in the public arena as a vocal advocate for European reform and is now playing a leading role in a new international grassroots movement for democracy in Europe. Yanis joins us today as his latest book on the origins of the European economic crisis is published. It's called And the Weak Suffer What They Must. I've been reading it for the next few days. It's a fantastic read. At times makes you want to laugh and at times makes you want to cry. So thank you for that. Can you possibly start? Oh, by the way, I should say, Chance, this painting in this room is a painting that describes the evolution of human history in the arts, commerce, and manufactures. And it starts, of course, in ancient Greece. So perhaps we can refer to that. Tell us about the title of your book, And the Weak Suffer What They Must.
Well, it comes straight out of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. It refers to the debate, a very sad and cruel debate, between the generals of the Athenian army that was sent to Milos, the island of Milos, to crush Milos. Why? Because Milos guarded jealously its independence during the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. And Athens thought that this was a terrible precedent. It would allow other states to imagine that they could escape taking sides, well, taking the side of Athens in particular. So they dispatched an army to Milos with the express command to crush them as a deterrent to others. And there was this wonderful dialogue that Thucydides relates between the generals and the Milian rulers. The Milians tried to impress upon the Athenians that there is a principle that one should always follow, the principle of treating others fairly, because the strong of today will become the weak of tomorrow. And the response by the Athenians was, I'm sorry, but this is the morality of the weak. That's, well, Nietzsche, but that's what they implied. The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. And they proceeded, of course, to raise Milos to the ground and sell whoever was left as slaves. But the reason why I picked this as a title was because when I was at Cambridge in the late 1980s, I was going through some of the artifacts and books of John Maynard Keynes. And it was at a time when I was also reading up on the history of the Bretton Woods system, the Bretton Woods Conference, which gave rise to the post-war golden era of capitalism, where John Maynard Keynes was, of course, representing the British government in the negotiations with the United States. The United States was being represented, President Roosevelt was represented by Harry White, and the two men clashed on how the post-war global financial order should be designed. And of course, Keynes lost, not because his arguments were weaker, but because Britain was weaker than the United States. And I got on my hand, I ended up holding a copy of Keynes's History of the Peloponnesian War. So I started looking at it, and it struck me that he had underlined that particular passage and that particular phrase, and the weak suffer what they must. So when I was writing my history or my take on the European Union and the reason for its disintegration and serious troubles at the moment, that idea came to me. And it came to me when I was writing the chapter in which Cain's, from the position of weakness that he had due to the fact that he was representing Britain in 1944, had to cave to the Americans' design of the post-war era. There, that's it. A long-winded answer.
No, it's a great answer. I want to explore some of the key points that you make in the book, which is a fascinating history of how it is we got to where we've got to. But let's do that through the prism of today's events, because we're about to enter into another round of negotiations between the European Union and Greece. Tell us what you think is going to be happening in that round of negotiations, and what for you is fundamentally wrong with the terms upon which those kind of negotiations will proceed.
Well, let me tell you what I think is fundamentally wrong. There are no negotiations. There is a pretense of negotiations. As the WikiLeaks story that broke very recently confirms, there is a massive tussle between the International Monetary Fund and Berlin. The elephants are tussling, and the little mouse, Greece, is being trampled upon. So there's no negotiation happening with the Greek government. The Greek government has effectively surrendered. It's the reason why I'm not in the ministry, thankfully for me personally, is that I was not prepared to sign the surrender document. The surrender, however, happened on the 6th of July, officially on the 13th of July of 2015. Ever since, the Greek government, you know, is just waiting to see what the great powers will decide. And the reason why the great powers are so indecisive, and the Greek economy is fading and fading and shrinking and shrinking, is because of two reasons. There are two tussles happening simultaneously. One is the one that I explained between the IMF and Berlin. The IMF's position is very difficult because they were dragged by European leaders. Remember, the IMF is effectively a United States-controlled organization, but has always a European leader. It was Dominique Strauss-Kahn, now it's Christine Lagarde, usually a French person. So the French leadership of the IMF dragged, on behalf of Germany, the IMF into the Greek bailout. The Greek bailout was a very cynical operation of taking the losses of German and French banks and putting them onto European taxpayers. They call this the bailout for Greece. Effectively, they took the largest amount of money ever, and the largest loan in history, and gave it to the most bankrupt European state, the Greek government, not for the Greek government to use it, but to give it to the French and the German banks, because they were in need of a second bailout. They had one in 2009, they needed another one in 2010. But of course they couldn't say this to their parliaments and their politicians and to their citizens, so they disguised it as an act of solidarity towards Greece. It was no such thing. But of course, they never expected that money to come back, because the reason why they gave it to Greece was because Greece was bankrupt. Greece owed money to the banks. They gave it to Greece to give it to the banks. They never expected Greece to get it back, because if Greece could pay it back, they would have paid it back to the banks directly. Yeah? So now the problem that Mrs. Merkel has, it's a serious problem, political problem she has. Ideally, she would go to the Bundestag, the federal parliament in Berlin, and confess that, you know, remember that money that we gave to the Greeks? We were never going to take it back. We knew it, and we lied to you. So she's not, especially in the weakened state in which she finds herself today because of the refugee crisis and so on, she cannot do that. So she's trying to delay the inevitable, which is what? A debt write-off or a debt restructure, call it what you will, a haircut. So she's loath to admit that that which must happen will happen. At the same time, the IMF has lent its legitimacy to this bailout by participating against its own charter. The IMF has some very simple rules. The most important rule of the IMF is you do not lend to a government that is insolvent. Well, they did it in 2010 with Greece, and they did again in 2012. They violated their constitution, and now they can't keep on doing it because members of the IMF, like the Malaysians, the Indonesians, the Brazilians, are revolting. They're saying, you know, enough is enough. We cannot keep financing an unsustainable debt. So they want to pull out of this. They want to force upon Merkel to accept, to go to the Bundestag and tell the truth. So this is the tussle between the IMF and Merkel. There's a second tussle. Greece is just a canary in the mine. Allow me to put it this way. Imagine that Cornwall was constantly in the news for 5 years as the source of instability for the British economy. And you had all these stories that the economy of there's a crisis in Cornwall and it threatens to bring Britain down. I can assure you that if this was happening for 5 years, there would be something wrong not with Cornwall, but with Britain. So Greece should have been sorted out ages ago. The fact that it's not being sorted out is a reflection of the conflict between Paris and Germany and Berlin on what to do with the Eurozone. The Eurozone was a terrible design. It was the most silly monetary design in the history of capitalism. It didn't work. It's fragmenting. They know it. How do I know they know it? Wolfgang Schäuble admitted it to me. He said, you know, you're right. It's not sustainable. Yeah? But they disagree amongst themselves as to how to fix it and what to do. In the meantime, they want Greece to just keep quiet, keep fading quietly in the corner, and not to create any problems while the big boys and girls decide what's going to happen in Europe. But they're not deciding because they are locked in a terrible, terrible conflict amongst themselves. Emmanuel Macron, possibly the only sensible minister in the Hollande administration, with whom I have many disagreements, but he's a smart chap, right? He put it to me, in front of others as well, it wasn't behind closed doors, that whenever he talks to Germany, by the way, Macron is the minister of France who is closer to the German government. Huh? So when he said this to me, I was astounded. He said that every time he speaks to German authorities about how to fix the Eurozone, he gets a confirmation back that we are living through a new 30-year war between Catholic and Calvinist Europe, which is spinning out of control. That's Emmanuel Macron saying this to me. Not, you know, this doesn't come from a left-wing Greek. So this is the reason why there are no negotiations. We didn't have negotiations. You know, for 5 months, I was not negotiating. I was negotiating for the right to negotiate. And I failed.
You see, it occurred to me that you could have used a different Keynes quote for this book.
Okay.
You could have used, in the long run, we're all dead.
I don't... Yeah. Because
in a sense, this kicking the can down the road... Yes. So this is where politics and economics become wound up. Of course, as you argue very convincingly in the book, the Greek issue could have been solved in a humane and reasonable way in which today's ordinary Greek people did not pay the price for the profligacy of their... rich and rulers in the past, and for the decisions that were made by investors in Wall Street and Germany, etc., could have been done. The fear was, had you succeeded, had Greece succeeded in this, then the political cry would have been for the similar compassion and reasonableness, rationality to be shown towards Portugal and Ireland and Spain and Italy and others. So is there an extent to which the strategy really is to say, well, look, Greece has to continue to suffer until the point at which, if we help Greece, it doesn't have that kind of knock-on effect on the rest of Europe?
Well, maybe the title for the book should be a twist on that Keynes quote. It should be, in the short run, we're all going to be dead. Because this crisis is not going to survive in the long run. Or Europe will not survive it in the long run. Look, let me challenge your proposition by saying that I don't believe that the solution to the Greek problem should be based on compassion. That, in a German mindset, translates to, oh, they want more money. Yeah? Compassion. To be more humane to Greece means to give them more money. No, my criticism of the bailouts was that Greece got too much money, not too little, but it got it for the wrong reason. And in the wrong way. And in the end, the German taxpayers, ended up paying a lot more money than they had to. So I'm accusing them of inefficiency, not lack of compassion. Yeah? So in the end, the humanitarian crisis is the result of idiocy, not of harshness.
That fascinates me, yes, because that takes me to one of the things that I found really intriguing about the book. because you're a very thoughtful man, and you are someone who thinks deeply about the structure of problems, the underlying structures that are driving things. But yet in your book, repeatedly, people just come across as being incredibly stupid. You know, the French in particular do not emerge from your book terribly well. And so that the Germans are kind of mean and self-interested.
Not in my book.
As you put it, not thinking rationally about how things have to work. So thinking in narrow self-interested terms, perhaps. The French get it wrong. Everybody kind of makes... One of the critics of your book, a friendly critic, but kind of argue that there's a sense in your book that it's not really what worries you is the technocrats running Europe, it's just it's the wrong technocrats running Europe. If we had better technocrats running Europe, things could be better. No, so what is the balance of the structural here?
I take the first part of your argument, but not the second. I don't believe that the technocrats could ever find a solution to this problem. This is a political problem and has to be sorted out politically. But the first part, look, there is no doubt, if you look at the last 5-6 years, that we've had a comedy of errors in the European Union. Every time our great and good leaders go together, they manage to outdo themselves at producing a major failure that managed to dwarf their previous failure. There's no doubt that there is a failure at the level of conceptualization. And if not, let's say that they were simply locked in a terrible kind of prisoner's dilemma that forced a terrible outcome upon them, but let's assume that they were very smart people who understood what was going on, then they have a moral responsibility to come out and say it. So we have to choose. Either they were morally defective or not particularly intelligent. But, you know, the idea that you give the largest loan in history to the most bankrupt of states and you expect this to end well, does not...
So what is it that drives it, then? That's what I'm trying to get to. Because people... These are not stupid people.
No, they're not stupid people.
And they are generally publicly spirited people
as
well.
But their salaries depend on not engaging too seriously with the facts. No, seriously. I believe that... So this is a systemic failure. And you have people who are... Look, let me put it this way to you. As proof that they're not stupid people. I'm trying to remember exactly when it happened. It was within 10 days after I assumed the finance ministry, and I happened to be in Brussels. And I had a long meeting with somebody quite high up in the Troika. I won't mention names, but it's not important who it was. Somebody really high up, whose name you know, and it's in the news and all that. And we were engaged with our teams, with our minders and so on, for many hours in conversations. And this is now after midnight, we were having a tête-à-tête, a private drink, just to wrap up the day. And I was astounded to hear the following. This person says to me, you know, Yanis, your analysis is, of course, correct. This thing can't work. This thing was the program that they were trying to impose upon us. The previous program which they wanted us to carry on implementing. Get the significance of the sentence. This thing can't possibly work. Not that it's difficult to make it work. It can't possibly work. It's like squaring the circle. It can't be done. It's not a question of how, you know, your willpower. Yeah? The next sentence. But we have invested huge political capital in it. So we cannot go back. And then the killer sentence. Looking at me and pointing at me. Your credibility, my credibility, as a finance minister of Greece, depends on you accepting it. There. That's the answer that you get. But the question is, why did they end up investing so much political capital in something they know deep down can't work? And why are they extending and pretending? Well, and that's what the book is about. Finding this, the key to this question in the DNA, in the way that the European Union was constructed, and then created a process that acquired its own spirit, esprit, and logic. And then those who are caught up as bureaucrats, as politicians in it, they have to make a choice that Larry Summers put to me beautifully when I was in Washington. I'm giving you all these acting anecdotes down. Because I learned in 5 months I had this roller coaster ride, and I learned a lot from these people. So another after midnight chat with Larry Summers over a glass of whiskey. I remember that. He said to me, he was actually on my side. He was one of my advisors. Yes, I know, Larry Summers. Anyway, he was extremely nice to me. He said, and this was his advice, and I think that answers to a large extent your question. He said, listen, Jens, you have a major decision to make at a personal level, not at the level of government. This is me talking to you as a friend and as an advisor. You have to choose. Are you an outsider or are you an insider? If you are an outsider, you will retain your right to speak your mind, to speak truth of power, to say whatever you want. If you're an insider, you get an opportunity to participate in decision-making. But there is a price to pay. Insiders cannot criticize other insiders. This is your choice. And I think that those whom we were discussing, it's not that they're stupid people, but they're insiders. So when they see that the process that they are party to is running out of control, they can talk to other insiders about this, but they can't talk to an audience like this, and they cannot allow their policies to be influenced by their rational thinking.
I mean, actually, to be fair, if you do want to understand the structural reasons why we are in the position we're in, this is the book for you to read, and you explain very carefully why it is that the flaws in the Bretton Woods Agreement, the impact of the dismantling of that agreement in the 1970s, and the attempts then by European countries to find a new basis for economic security goes wrong. So read the book if you want to understand that fully. As you know, because we were talking to you before we came in, we're the RSA leading a project on what we call Citizens Economic Council, which is an attempt to engage 30 ordinary citizens in a kind of two-year process of understanding key economic concepts and radical economic ideas. And we're doing this because the debate that took place in the last general election about economics was as pathetic as you can possibly imagine. And it was completely empty, and it involved one party making a set of promises which they've now reneged upon and accusing another party of doing things which are now... Anyway, just forget it. It's all completely hopeless. The question, however, is this. In my annual lecture last year, I said that I'm a sociologist, but no one has ever said to me they can't talk about society because they haven't got a sociology degree. But people do say they can't talk about economics because they haven't got an economics degree. Economics governs our lives, and yet most people have the flimsiest awareness of economic concepts, much less the confidence to use them. Isn't that a massive problem for our democracy, that these great forces, these great impersonal forces... I mean, you know, people in Greece should have understood in the glory years that this was all built on sand. But how were they to even to understand that, for example?
Well, when you live in a bubble, it's very difficult to know you live in a bubble, right? But let me do something that I'm qualified to do, being an academic economist. Let me make a provocatory statement towards my profession by saying that understanding economics well impedes an understanding of the economy. So not being an economist and not understanding economics gives you an opportunity, no guarantee. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition for approaching the economy and the economic problems of our lives sensibly. Why am I saying that? Economics has become, in the last 25 years or so, the queen of the social sciences. So there used to be, we used to have the humanities, we used to have social studies, where you had the politics, economics, history, and so on. And these were all part and parcel of this collective enterprise to make sense of the society we live in. But around the mid to late 70s, together with the rise of neoliberalism, you have the rise of economics as the social science, the real social science, whereas everything else, yeah, remember, Mrs. Thatcher wanting to close down sociology departments. Yeah? Because if you have economics, why do you need sociology? So the rise of economics as the science of society took the form of the domination of economic thinking by a particular model, a mathematical model, of how the world works. Now, the power of algebra is immense. If the moment a child solves an equation. He or she feels power. This is the beauty of truth. Yeah? So if you have a system of equations, you have a natural tendency, if you know some algebra, to try to solve it. And when you solve it, you feel, yes, I've done something that has, you know, like Euclidean geometry. You prove a Euclidean theorem or the Pythagorean theorem, and you feel this is unalloyed truth. So this is a very strong political feeling. If you manage to transfer it to social science, if you can say that, look, this is not a question of Labour Party versus Conservative by what we think about the surplus or the public sector borrowing requirement. There is a theorem here which proves beyond reasonable doubt that we should do X and not Y. If you have this capacity as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, you have an economist in the next room who solves the equations and tells you, this is what, there is no alternative, this is the truth. And then you can go to the House of Commons and you say, this is it, everybody else is a charlatan. That gives you immense power. Now, the problem with this is that if you, the rise of the dominance of this mathematical model in economics, I usually call it neoclassical model, which goes together with the aesthetic of the room. To solve the mathematics of an economy, you've got to make assumptions that ensure, guarantee, that that model has nothing to do with really existing capitalism. So the only way to succeed as an economist in an economics profession that has been mathematized is to remove yourself from the real economy. So you have to become structurally and deeply irrelevant to the world you live in order to understand your model of that world. This is why I'm saying that if you are of that mindset, let me give you a particular example. To make the mathematics solvable, you've got to assume that there can never be a crisis. Because the moment there can be a crisis, you have indeterminacy and the mathematics cannot be solved. So the Queen asked the Royal Economic Society after 2008, why didn't you predict it? And they got together and they wrote a letter, and it was a very pathetic attempt. Yeah? The real reason is that their mathematics precluded a crisis from ever happening. It was the only way they could publish their papers and get promoted. And in the financial sector, when you asked the head of Royal Bank of Scotland, they had 2,500 risk management analysts. 2,500. That's a joke, isn't it? Why did you get it wrong? Why didn't these 2,500 people whose job was to manage risk, why did they get it wrong? Because their equations had exactly the same assumptions inside. To solve those equations and to be able to report to the CEO, our prediction is this. They had to convert variables into parameters in the model, and this conversion could only make sense if there could never be correlated bankruptcies. In other words, never a crisis. So this is, again, a long-winded answer to your question. There are no experts on economics, and there can be no experts in economics. This is where Plato was pathetically wrong. He was such an anti-democrat, such a hater of democracy, and he believed that you simply take the expert. Like, if you want to build a bridge, you take an expert to build it, you don't do it democratically. Correct. But when it comes to managing the economy, that's managing power. That's managing society, managing politics. There can be no expert. Why? Because the mathematics is not soluble. And the only way you can solve it is by making assumptions that are toxic and lead to bad mathematics, bad economics, and failed banks.
You wrote a piece for The Guardian this morning. Now, the RSA as a charity, it will be entirely impartial in relation to the forthcoming referendum. But I read the piece and I thought if I was arguing for a staying in vote, I would feel quite ambivalent about your piece. Because on the one hand, you say Britain should stay in the European Union. So I think that's great. And then your argument basically is you should stay in because it's completely crap. But as long as Britain stays in, there'll be one or two of us who are trying to make it better. And I thought, I'm not sure that's going to convince that many people. So I'm obviously traducing your argument. But do you want to share with us why it is you're encouraging the people of Britain to vote to stay in?
Look, where do I begin? That the European Union is abysmal, there's no doubt. So anybody who wants to convince you to vote for Remain, who starts by saying, "Oh, the European Union is rosy and wonderful and beautiful," and don't listen to the to its bashers and so on, and vote to stay in, you're not going to convince anyone, because you can't fool people that way. The reason why I'm arguing in favor of the Remain is twofold. Firstly, you can't really get out even if you vote for Brexit. The Brexit argument is that Britain will reclaim its sovereignty from Brussels, do good things with the Chinese, with the Americans, and so on, sort of sail away under the Atlantic towards a kind of reconstituted empire, but remain in the single market of Europe. That simply can't be done. A single market is not the same thing as a free trade area. It's not just a question of not having tariffs and quotas. A single market, to be a genuine single market, requires three things in addition to free trade. It requires common industry standards. So the gadgets that are sold here must have exactly the same standards as the ones that are sold in Estonia and in Greece and in Portugal. Somebody has to decide what those standards are. And, you know, who decides those standards also decides which companies to favor to a very large extent. So it's a political issue. It's not a technical issue. Secondly, you need similar or identical, I would say identical, labor protection standards. Because if you don't, then you have a market, you know, let's say that Greece goes back to slavery and we allow slaves to be employed, then suddenly we have an unfair competitive advantage against countries where slavery is not allowed. So to have a single market, you have to have a level playing field when it comes to labor markets. So you have to have harmonization of labor market legislation to have a genuine single market. And you need common environmental protection standards. So if Polish companies are allowed to pollute to their heart's content, whereas Welsh or English or Scottish companies are not, then that creates a competitive disadvantage, not a single market. But if you're going to have common industry standards, labor market standards, and environmental protection standards, you need to have three branches of power to impose those standards. You need a common judiciary, you need a common legislature, and you need a common executive to impose those pieces of legislation. So you need a state. So you need full sovereignty anyway to be in the single market. And if you step out of the European Union, effectively what you're saying is, we're going to give all this authority to Brussels and we're not even going to be in it. So this is my Hotel California quip. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. Yeah? So that's the first reason why you should stay in.
You know what this reminds me of? I don't know if you've been watching Trapped, the Icelandic series, but this is like Britain as Andre, kind of wandering around as everybody kills everybody else in this kind of blasted, snow intense, you know, there's nothing we can do. We just have to kind of wander around looking miserable.
No, there's a lot we can do.
Ah, good.
But we can't just leave. We cannot just take our stumps and leave. The second reason for staying in is that the greatest fallacy in this debate, pseudo-debate, because the debate is really very poor, just like prior to your general election, both sides make this mistake of the referendum. They assume that the European Union is a constant. It's a given. It's on the other side of the British Channel. It's there. And then they're fighting amongst each other as to whether this is something we want to be part of or not. Well, the European Union is not a given. It's not a constant. It is a disintegrating lot. It is changing, and it's changing in a very bad way, in a way that already is creating huge centrifugal forces that are pulling France apart from Germany. I mentioned that before, the north from the south, and now the east from the west. And this manifests itself in a variety of ways, not just in terms of the banking crisis, the debt crisis, but also in terms of the refugees, our inability to deal with a problem that we should be able to deal with quite easily if we were united and had a proper European Union. Brexit would destabilize further and accelerate the disintegration of the European Union. Now, if I am right in my prognosis, and this is part of this book's raison d'etre, that the disintegration of the European Union is going to lead to a major division between Germanic states, surplus states. I'm talking about a fault line developing along the Rhine, the River Rhine, and then the Alps, with countries like Germany, Poland, Austria, the Netherlands, Finland, the Baltics, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, becoming one bloc with effectively the Deutschmark, a reconstituted Deutschmark.
It was the Golden Triangle, didn't it, that space?
Well, it will be golden, and that would be a terrible thing, because the Deutschmark, which will be golden, is going to go through the roof. It will be appreciating massively, as everybody will be expecting it to, therefore it will. And that will create a very serious deflationary shock that will in turn boost unemployment no end in places like Germany and so on, converting lowly paid workers into unemployed workers. The rest of Europe, with a depreciating currency that they will have, or currencies that they will have, will be facing significant inflation and low employment and low investment. That will be like a black hole in the middle of the European continent. Britain, whether you stay in or stay out, is going to be consumed by it. You are not going to be able to escape. It will be another Great Depression. It will be another 1930s. So, firstly, you are not going to reclaim your sovereignty by getting out. And secondly, you will be destabilizing Europe further, accelerating a process that will make Britain suffer. That is a good reason to stay in. And, you know, Jon Snow in Channel 4 News yesterday said, very briefly, you know how television is, very briefly, Yanis, what would you do if you were British and you had to vote? I would say I would vote to stay in to fight Brussels from within.
Now, at the very end of in the last 2 or 3 minutes, I'm going to ask you to talk about the movement that you've created, because I think people will be interested in hearing what you're doing and how you're trying to do it. But let's take some questions before we come to that. And what we'll do is we'll take them 3 or 4 together, yes. We'll start here.
Terence Bendixson, thank you for a very stimulating talk. Just a simple question. You seem to think that the European Union is really in a very parlous state. I think many of us do. Isn't it going to collapse anyway? And wouldn't it be better to be outside it when the collapse happens than inside it?
Hold on to that thought.
Thank you. Delbert Sanderford. I agree with everything you said about the mathematical take on economics these days. But you have to have a model for making decisions. If you go back to Keynes, he had a very powerful narrative. If you look at something like development economics, Arthur Lewis had a very powerful narrative. No maths at all, but a very strong, logical narrative. Where would your narrative come from to help governments make decisions?
Thank you. Edmund Burke said that magnanimity was the greatest political virtue. Do you think it's possible in a democracy for governments to say, we've got this wrong, it can't work, like lending huge amounts of money to an insolvent state? Is that possible?
And to add to that, can governments in a democracy say, we're going to do what's in the interests of the international community, not what's in the interests of our own nation in the short term? So, yes, if I can add that. So, if it's going to collapse, it wouldn't be better to be outside watching it collapse than be inside the building. What is the kind of economic narrative that we need right now? And can democracies be magnanimous and long-term in their thinking?
Well, no, I don't think that it makes much difference whether you're in or out. The building is collapsing, and whether you are in the heart of it or, you know, just on the side of it, it will be catastrophic. And I think that Britain should stay in, because by staying in, this country has a lot to offer in the collective struggle of sensible European democrats to prevent the collapse, and even to handle a collapse if it happens. It would be much better handled if Britain stays in than if Britain doesn't. One of my criticisms of George Osborne during my time in ECOFIN was that when anything was discussed in ECOFIN that had to do something with the Eurozone, George Osborne simply abstained on the basis that it's got nothing to do with us. You created this Eurozone, we didn't like it, we stayed out, none of our problems. That was a big mistake, because Britain was affected by every silly decision we took in the Eurozone. So that's my answer to your question. On the question of economic concepts and models, of course we need sensible economic thinking. And you gave the example of Keynes. I could give the example of many others as well, from a different political perspective. But what all this sensible economic theorists had in common was an appreciation of indeterminacy. So Keynes understood the limits of his reasoning. He understood that, you know, he could advise governments on what to do with fiscal policy and monetary policy, but he understood that this advice was part of a conception that wasn't determinate. That there were all sorts of, so you will allow me to be Australian for a moment. I had an Australian colleague at the University of Sydney who used to introduce his students to Keynes's economics by saying that the essence of what Keynes is telling us is that we're buggered if we know. And that is important for governments to know, the limits of their knowledge about the indeterminacy of capitalism. So, yes, we need models, but we also need to transcend them and constantly to understand that that capitalism is indeterminate. And if we forget that, we end up in serious trouble. On the question of that you put to me, well, it's extremely hard for politicians. Actually, it's very hard for each one of us as individuals to admit mistakes. Yeah? But until and unless our governments have the capacity to do this, they will not be legitimate in the eyes of their own electorate. So I think that what the developments, both in the United States with Bernie Sanders, even that awful man Trump, the developments in Greece with Syriza, the developments throughout, wherever you turn your eyes to, show that electorates are hungry for some honesty from government, from governments that have the capacity to say to them, you know what, we messed up, or that was a mistake, let's try something else. And regarding your question, your addendum to the original question, I think it's virtually impossible for governments to be altruistic and to espouse policies which are bad for their own nations and good for the rest of the world. But I don't think it's necessary. My criticism of our governments is that in pursuing the narrow self-interest of the governing elite, they're undermining simultaneously their own people's prospects and the international community.
I just want to take this a little bit further, because this is something that you talk about a lot. Democracy. You talked about in your article, you talk about in your book, it's in the name of your movement. But I worry slightly that in pulling apart the kind of lazy nostrums of neoclassical economics, you replace them with a kind of belief that democracy is rational, and that democracy is simply, one simply has to assert democracy for problems to resolve themselves. Elections, what we call democracy, representative democracy, is simply a way of getting rid of bad governments from time to time. It doesn't provide much of a mandate. And as we have seen, populism is on the rise, and populism is often associated with very dishonest accounts of how problems can be solved. So what is the nature of your faith in democracy, that it will lead to better decisions, better both rationally but also better in ethically, ultimately?
Well, democracy is a work in progress to begin with. Like beauty, it cannot be defined. If you try to define it fully, you end up losing it. But there is Britain is a good place to have this debate, because unlike in France or in Germany, there is a deeper appreciation of parliamentary democracy. The idea that you have a sovereign parliament which can call to account those who make decisions on behalf of everybody else. Yeah, this is what we don't have in Europe. I felt that when I was in the Eurogroup, we were making momentous decisions, decisions that will affect the lives of hundreds of millions of people, and not just in Europe. And we did it in conditions of pure opacity. Nobody knew what we were deciding. Not even the ministers who were deciding what they were deciding didn't know what they were deciding, because it was already prearranged in some dark corner of that building. And it was just preposterous. We were making decisions without any briefing. We would make decisions about Spain. Spain is a huge economy, very important economy. Do you know how much information I had on this as one of the ministers that I was passing judgment on? Zero. Not one piece of A4. So the lack of transparency. This is why I keep DiEM's first campaign is for transparency. I felt that if only those cameras that we had in the room, and we had many, were connected to the internet, and people could actually see what we were doing. That would improve immensely the quality of the debate. It would prevent certain people from saying things that we're saying that were coloring the debate and leading to bad outcomes and bad decisions. As a first step, but a massive first step, this transparency campaign that we're running is essential. Because if, you know, uninformed people cannot exercise their sovereign democratic right. Secondly, you know, people say to me, but why are you claiming that Europe is not democratic? It's fully democratic. All of you were elected. You know, you all had to go through the rigmarole of elections to be there. You presented your country, the European Union Council, comprised of democratically elected head of state, ECOFIN, democratically elected finance ministers. Yes, this is true, but it is irrelevant. Because you go to the Eurogroup or the EU Council, okay, you, behind closed doors, in pure opacity, you make decisions. Yeah? Then that body that made that decision is not accountable to anyone. Individuals go back home, and they all denounce what they had agreed upon. Or they distance themselves from it. They say, oh, this is the best. You know, Cameron comes back, it's the best I could come back from Brussels with. I would go back to Athens and denounce the decision. Schäuble would go to Germany and say, oh, this is a terrible decision, it was the best we could do. So nobody defends it, really. And there is no parliament that can hold to account that body as a body. We can't dismiss the Eurogroup. The European Parliament is not a parliament, it's a joke. Yeah? A parliament that cannot does not have the right to initiate legislation and cannot dismiss the body that makes the decisions. It's not a parliament. It's a job creation scheme for people who get elected.
What we've established is the thing I just wanted to say.
So we need the parliament. What you understand in this country as parliamentary democracy, we have to have it in Europe.
It's very simple. I'm going to take more questions. I just wanted to establish that just as when it comes to economics, we shouldn't just say leave the market to decide. When it comes to democracy, that doesn't just mean do what the people say today. It means a whole set of other things.
No. Yeah. Lynch mobs have majority rule, but they do not constitute democratic processes.
Great. Thank you. Let's take the question over there.
Thank you. My name is Liliana Pop. I'm a fellow. I want to try and get you maybe to address a question that was asked earlier by Matthew. Why didn't Greece understand it was all built on sand at the time? It seems to me that many economists now accept your argument that austerity is counterproductive, debt forgiveness is practically the only reasonable answer to the situation. But it still seems helpful if this were to be accepted politically. Maybe, I wonder what you think about this, if Greece were to provide an account of why this happened and how it's not going to happen again?
A bit more mea culpa from Greece might help the politics of this. Yes?
Thank you. Joe Gideon. You made a very persuasive argument about why you can't, as an insider, reform. And yet you suggest that Britain, as an insider, could reform the EU. I'd like to know how you square those two statements.
These questions are getting harder and harder, if you notice. we'll take the gentleman there.
My question's very easy. It's about NATO. The purpose of government, the primary purpose of government, is to protect its people. How do you think the disintegration or the realignment of Europe with Britain, UK leaving, would affect the NATO alliance?
My goodness, that's a big question as well. I'm sorry we can't take any more. Try your best on those three.
On the Greek situation, allow me to say this. Firstly, you may have heard that I am a left-winger. I spent my youth demonstrating against Greek governments and against the Greek oligarchy, so I can give you long, long accounts of everything that is wrong with Greece. But also allow me to say that imagine that in 1999 we had an epiphany, or the elites in Greece had an epiphany, and we didn't enter the Eurozone like you didn't enter the Eurozone. Huh? We wouldn't be discussing Greece today. Greece would have had a much slower growth rate in the 2000s. 2008 we have a minor dip like Bulgaria did. Are we discussing Bulgaria? No, it would be the same thing. It would still be corrupt, it would still be this, that. We would still have our demonstrations. I would still be demonstrating on the streets of Athens, but you would not be discussing Greece. The reason why we're discussing Greece is because it became part of a terrible design at the level of Europe, and the reason why we have this huge debt was because of that. The second question was about insiders. Well, I didn't suggest that Britain should become an insider in the European Union. I suggest that Britain should stay inside the European Union. So there's a very big difference. Yeah? At the moment, Britain is an insider. So Cameron goes behind closed doors, has very silly conversations with other people there, and he's an insider. He's trusted because he doesn't come out here to tell you exactly what was discussed. And on the question of NATO, look, do you think that Putin would be as uppity as he has been if Europe had not been consuming itself with this terrible crisis of the last 5 years as a result of its terrible design? I don't think so. As for NATO, permit me to say something that may resonate badly. I think it's obsolete. And interestingly, we spent quite a few years in the United States, and I was teaching in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs together with fellow professors who had spent their lifetimes within the American Pentagon, the military, in NATO. Indeed, the dean of the school used to be both a high-ranking officer in NATO and also a deputy director of the NSA, but that's another matter. And he agrees with me. He thinks that after the Cold War ended, Europe should take care of its own defense, and NATO's expansion into the former Soviet Union has been destabilizing. So that's just so as to be provocative. The disintegration of the European Union is going to make life extremely more precarious for our citizens, and our security is going to be seriously jeopardized. There's no doubt about it.
And we've run out of time, but if people want to know more about give us in one paragraph, tell us about the movement that you're involved in establishing and how people can find out more about it.
Yes, we call it the Democracy in Europe movement, DiEM25, because we think that if we don't sort out Europe by 2025, there will be nothing left to sort out. And it's not a political party. We're not in competition with political parties. We think that Europe is disintegrating. This is a bad thing. We may be right or wrong, but this is what we're saying. And the only way to save it is by creating the pooled sovereignty along the lines of principles of parliamentary democracy that the Brits understand at the level of Europe. And the only way to do this is through three steps. Firstly, transparency. People need to understand what's going on in Brussels, otherwise nothing will change for the good. Secondly, stabilization. We need to coordinate economic policies under the existing institutions with coordinated monetary policy between the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and so on, so that quantitative easing converts itself into a serious increase in aggregate investment throughout Europe and in Britain, because this is a prerequisite for stability, so that once we have stabilized Europe, we can then begin the conversation on the constitutional process that will create the pooled sovereignty that is uniquely capable of stabilizing not just continental Europe, but also Britain. And so we think of ourselves as an infrastructure where Democrats from across Europe, independently of where they're left-wing, right-wing, liberals, greens, whatever, can come together to have these discussions, which we have never had in Europe, about how to address common problems in a common manner.
Well, Hans, thank you very much. This wonderful book, and it is a spellbinding book. I'm not an economist, and it's full of economic history, but I was enthralled by every word of it. It's available outside. And Yanis, please sign it for people if they buy it. That would be very, very kind of you. So please grab a copy of the book and come in, and Yanis will sign it afterwards. It's been a fantastic session. I'm very sorry that I wasn't able to take more questions, and I hog too much of the time, but that's what happens when you have such a fascinating speaker. So please join me in thanking Yanis Varoufakis.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.